Chapter 3. Peter Sees the Light. 1. She thought she had seen something different about Peter, but hadn't been able to tell exactly what it was. When Anderson woke up the next morning at a perfectly normal 9 o'clock, she saw it almost at once. She stood at the counter pouring gravy train into Peter's old red dish. As always, Peter came strolling in at the sound. The gravy train was fairly new. Up until this year, the deal had always been Gaines' meal in the morning, half a can of rival canned dog food at night, and everything Pete could catch in the woods in between. Then Peter had stopped eating the Gaines' meal, and it had taken Anderson almost a month to catch on. Peter wasn't bored. What remained of his teeth simply couldn't manage to crunch up the nuggets anymore. So now he got gravy train, the equivalent, she supposed, of an old man's poached egg for breakfast. She ran warm water over the gravy train nuggets, then stirred them with the old battered spoon she kept for the purpose. Soon the softening nuggets floated in a muddy liquid that actually did look like gravy. Either that, Anderson thought, or something out of a backed-up septic tank. "Here you go," she said, turning away from the sink. Peter was now in his accustomed spot on the linoleum, a polite distance away so Anderson wouldn't trip over him when she turned around, and thumping his tail. "Hope you enjoy it. Myself, I think I'd Ralph my g—" That was where she stopped, bent over with Peter's red dish in her right hand, her hair falling over one eye. She brushed it away. "Pete?" she heard herself say. Peter looked at her quizzically for a moment and then padded forward to get his morning kip. A moment later, he was slurping it up enthusiastically. Anderson straightened, looking at her dog, rather glad she could no longer see Peter's face. In her head, her grandfather's voice told her again to leave it alone. It was dangerous. And did she need any more string for her beads? There are about 1 million people in this country alone who would come running if they got wind of this kind of dangerous, Anderson thought. God knows how many in the rest of the world. And is that all it does? How is it on cancer, do you suppose? All the strength suddenly ran out of her legs. She felt her way backward until she touched one of the kitchen chairs. She sat down and watched Peter eat. The milky cataract, which had covered his left eye, was now half gone. 2. "I don't have the slightest idea," the vet said that afternoon. Anderson sat in the examining room's only chair, while Peter sat obediently on the examining table. Anderson found herself remembering how she had dreaded the possibility of having to bring Peter to the vets this summer. Only now, it didn't look as if Peter would have to be put down after all. "But it isn't just my imagination?" Anderson asked, and she supposed that what she really wanted was for Dr. Etheridge to either confirm or confute the Anne in her head. "It's what you deserve, living out there alone with your smelly dog." "Nope," Etheridge said, "although I can understand why you feel flummoxed. I feel a little flummoxed myself." "His cataract is in active remission. You can get down, Peter." Peter climbed down from the table, going first to Etheridge's stool, and then to the floor, and then to Anderson. Anderson put her hand on Peter's head and looked closely at Etheridge, thinking, "Did you see that?" Not quite wanting to say it out loud. For a moment, Etheridge met her eyes, and then he looked away. "I saw it, yes, but I'm not going to admit that I saw it." Peter had gotten down carefully, in a descent that was miles from the devil-take-the-hindmost bounds of the puppy he had once been, but neither was it the trembling, tentative, wobbly descent Peter would have made even a week ago, cocking his head unnaturally to the right, so he could see where he was going, his balance so vague that your heart stopped until he was down with no bones broken. Peter came down with the conservative yet solid confidence of the elder statesman he had been 2 or 3 years ago. Some of it, Anderson supposed, was the fact that the vision in his left eye was returning. Etheridge had confirmed that with a few simple perception tests. But the eye wasn't all of it. The rest was overall improved body coordination. Simple as that. Crazy, but simple. And the shrinking cataract hadn't caused Pete's muzzle to return to salt and pepper from an almost solid white, had it? Anderson had noticed that in the pickup truck as they headed down to Augusta. She had almost driven off the road. How much of this was Etheridge seeing and not being prepared to admit he was seeing? Quite a bit, Anderson guessed. But part of it was just that Etheridge wasn't Doc Daggett. Daggett had seen Peter at least twice a year during the first 10 years of Peter's life. And then there were the things that came up, like the time Pete had mixed in with a porcupine, for instance, and Daggett had removed the quills, one by one, whistling the theme music from The Bridge on the River Kwai as he did so, soothing the trembling year-old dog with one big kindly hand. On another occasion, Peter had come limping home with a backside full of birdshot, a cruel present from a hunter, either too stupid to look before he shot, or perhaps sadistic enough to inflict misery on a dog because he couldn't find a partridge or pheasant to inflict it on. Dr. Daggett would have seen all the changes in Peter, and would not have been able to deny them even if he had wished to. Dr. Daggett would have taken off his pink-rimmed glasses, polished them on his white coat, and said something like, "We have to find out where he's been and what he's gotten into, Roberta. This is serious. Dogs don't just get younger. And that is what Peter appears to be doing." That would have forced Anderson to reply, "I know where he's been, and I've got a pretty good idea of what did it." And that would have taken a lot of the pressure off, wouldn't it? But old Doc Daggett had sold the practice to Etheridge, who seemed nice enough but who was still something of a stranger, and retired to Florida. Etheridge had seen Peter more often than Daggett had done, 4 times in the last year, as it happened, because as Peter grew older he had grown steadily more infirm, but he still hadn't seen him as often as his predecessor, and, she suspected, he didn't have his predecessor's clear-eyed perceptions, or his guts. From the ward behind them, a German shepherd suddenly exploded a string of heavy barks that sounded like a string of canine curses. Other dogs picked it up. Peter's ears cocked forward, and he began to tremble under Anderson's hand. The Benjamin Button routine apparently hadn't done a thing for the beagle's equanimity, Anderson thought. Once through his puppyhood storms, Peter had been so laid back he was damn near paralytic. This high-strung trembling was brand new. Etheridge was listening to the dogs with a slight frown. Now almost all of them were barking. "Thanks for seeing us on such short notice," Anderson said. She had to raise her voice to be heard. A dog in the waiting room also started to bark, the quick, nervous yappings of a very small animal, a palm or a poodle, most likely. It was very... Her voice broke momentarily. She felt a vibration under her fingertips, and her first thought, the ship, was of the thing in the woods. But she knew what this vibration was. Although she had felt it very, very seldom, there was no mystery about it. This vibration was coming from Peter. Peter was growling, very low and deep in his throat. "Kind of you, but I think we ought to split. Sounds like you've got a mutiny on your hands." She meant it as a joke, but it no longer sounded like a joke. Suddenly, the entire small complex, the cinderblock square that was Etheridge's waiting room and treatment room, plus the attached cinderblock rectangle that was his ward and operating theater, was in an uproar. All the dogs out back were barking. And in the waiting room, the palm had been joined by a couple of other dogs, and a feminine wavering wail that was unmistakably feline. Mrs. Alden popped in, looking distressed. "Dr. Etheridge—" "All right," he said, sounding cross. "Excuse me, Miss Anderson." He left in a hurry, heading for the first ward. When he opened the door, the noise of the dogs seemed to double. "They're going bug shit," Anderson thought. And that was all she had time to think, because Peter almost lunged out from under her hand. That idling growl deep in his throat suddenly roughened into a snarl. Etheridge, already hurrying down the ward's central corridor, dogs barking all around him and the door swinging slowly shut on its pneumatic elbow behind him, didn't hear, but Anderson did, and if she hadn't been lucky in her grab for Peter's collar, the beagle would have been across the room like a shot and into the ward after the doctor. The trembling and the deep growl. Those hadn't been fear, she realized. They had been rage. It was inexplicable, completely unlike Peter, but that's what it had been. Peter's snarl turned into a strangled sound, "Yawk," as Anderson pulled him back by the collar. He turned his head, and in Peter's rolling red-rimmed right eye, Anderson saw what she would later characterize only as fury at being turned from the course he wanted to follow. She could acknowledge the possibility that there was a flying saucer 300 yards around its outer rim buried on her property, the possibility that some emanation or vibration from this ship had killed a woodchuck that had the bad luck to get a little too close, killed it so completely and unpleasantly that even the flies seemingly wanted no part of it. She could deal with an anomalous menstrual period, a canine cataract in her emission, even with the seeming certainty that her dog was somehow growing younger. All this, yes. But the idea that she had seen an insane hate for her, for Bobby Anderson, in her good old dog Peter's eyes. No. 3. That moment was thankfully brief. The door to the ward shut, muffling the cacophony. Some of the tenseness seemed to go out of Peter. He was still trembling, but at least he sat down again. "Come on, Pete, we're getting out of here," Anderson said. She was badly shaken, much more so than she would later admit to Jim Gardiner. For to admit that would have perhaps led back to that furious leer of rage she had seen in Peter's good eye. She fumbled for the unfamiliar leash, which she had taken off Peter as soon as they got into the examination room. That dogs should be leashed when owners brought them in for examination was a requirement Anderson had always found annoying, until now, almost dropping it. At last she managed to attach it to Peter's collar. She led Peter to the door of the waiting room and pushed it open with her foot. The noise was worse than ever. The yapper was indeed a Pomeranian, the property of a fat woman wearing bright yellow slacks and a yellow top. Fatso was trying to hold the palm, telling it to be a good boy, Eric, or be a good boy for Mommy. Very little save the dog's bright and somehow ratty eyes were visible between Mommy's large and flabby arms. "Miss Anderson," Mrs. Alden began. She looked bewildered and a little frightened, a woman trying to conduct business as usual in a place that had suddenly become a madhouse. Anderson understood how she felt. The palm spotted Peter. Anderson would later swear that was what set it off, and seemed to go crazy. It certainly had no problem choosing a target. It sank its sharp teeth into one of Mommy's arms.
"Cocksucker!"
Mommy screamed, and dropped the palm on the floor. Blood began to run down her arm. At the same time, Peter lunged forward, barking and snarling, fetching up at the end of the short leash hard enough to jerk Anderson forward. Her right arm flagged out straight. With the clear eye of her rider's mind, Anderson saw exactly what was going to happen next. Peter the Beagle and Eric the Palm were going to meet in the middle of the room like David and Goliath, but the Palm had no brains, let alone a sling. Peter would tear its head off with one large chomp. This was averted by a girl of perhaps 11, who was sitting to Mommy's left. The girl had a porticary on her lap. Inside was a large black snake, its scales glowing with luxuriant good health. The little girl shot out one jeans-clad leg with the unearthly reflexes of the very young and stomped on the trailing end of Eric's leash. Eric did one complete snap roll. The little girl reeled the palm in. She was by far the calmest person in the waiting room.
"What if that little fucker gave me the rabies?"
Mommy was screaming as she advanced across the room toward Mrs. Alden.
Blood twinkled between the fingers clapped to her arm.
Peter's head turned toward her as she passed, and Anderson pulled him back, heading toward the door. "Fuck the little sign in Mrs. Alden's cubbyhole," reading, "It is customary to pay cash for professional services unless other arrangements have been made in advance." She wanted to get out of here and drive the speed limit all the way home and have a drink. Cuddy, a double. On second thought, make that a triple. From her left came a long, low, virulent hissing sound. Anderson turned in that direction and saw a cat that might have stepped out of a Halloween decoration. Black, except for a single dab of white at the end of its tail. It had backed up as far as its carrying cage would allow. Its back was humped up. Its fur stood straight up in hackles. Its green eyes, fixed unwaveringly on Peter, glowed fantastically. Its pink mouth was jointed wide, ringed with teeth.
"Get your dog out, lady,"
the woman with the cat said in a voice cold as a cocking trigger.
"Blackie don't like him."
Anderson wanted to tell her she didn't care if Blackie farted or blew a tin whistle, but she would not think of this obscure but somehow exquisitely apt expression until later. She rarely did in hot situations. Her characters always knew exactly the right things to say, and she rarely had to deliberate over them. They came easily and naturally. This was almost never the case in real life. "Hold your water," was the best she could do, and she spoke it in such a craven mutter that she doubted if Blackie's owner had the slightest idea what she had said, or maybe even that she had said anything at all. She really was pulling Peter now, using the leash to yank the dog along in a way she hated to see a dog pulled whenever she observed it being done on the street. Peter was making coughing noises in his throat, and his tongue was a saliva-dripping runner hanging askew from one side of his mouth. He stared at a boxer whose right foreleg was in a cast. A big man in a blue mechanic's coverall was holding the boxer's rope leash with both hands. Had, in fact, taken a double twist of the hay rope around one big grease-stained fist, and was still having trouble holding his dog, which could have killed Peter as quickly and efficiently as Peter himself could have the Pomeranian. The boxer was pulling mightily in spite of its broken leg, and Anderson had more faith in the mechanic's grip than she did the hay rope leash, which appeared to be fraying. It seemed to Anderson that she fumbled for the knob of the outer door with her free hand for 100 years. It was like having a nightmare, where your hands are full and your pants start slowly and inexorably to slip down. Peter did this, somehow. She turned the knob, then took one final hasty glance around the waiting room. It had become an absurd little no-man's land. Mommy was demanding first aid of Mrs. Alden, and apparently really did need some. Blood was now coursing down her arm in freshets, spotting her yellow slacks and white institutional shoes. Blackie the cat was still hissing. Even Dr. Etheridge's gerbils were going mad in the complicated maze of plastic tubes and towers on the far shelf that made up their home. Eric, the crazed Pomeranian, stood at the end of his leash barking at Peter in a strangled voice. Peter was snarling back. Anderson's eye fell on the little girl's black snake and saw that it had reared up like a cobra inside its porticary and was also looking at Peter, its fangless mouth yawning, its narrow pink tongue shuttling at the air in stiff little jabs.
Black snakes don't do that. I never saw a black snake do that in my life.
Now, in something very close to real horror, Anderson fled, dragging Peter after her. 4. Pete began to calm down almost as soon as the door sighed shut behind them. He stopped coughing and dragging on the leash and began to walk at Anderson's side, glancing at her occasionally in that way that said, "I don't like this leash, and I'm never going to like it, but okay, okay, if it's what you want." By the time they were both in the cab of the pickup, Peter was entirely his old self again. Anderson was not. Her hands were shaking so badly that she had to try 3 times before she could get the ignition key into its slot. Then she popped the clutch and stalled the engine. The Chevy pickup gave a mighty jerk, and Peter tumbled off the seat onto the floor. He gave Anderson a reproachful beagle look. Although all dogs are capable of reproachful looks, only beagles seem to have mastered that long-suffering stare.
"Where did you say you got your license, Bobby?"
that expression seemed to ask.
"Sears and Roebuck?"
Then he climbed up on the seat again. Anderson was already finding it hard to believe that only 5 minutes ago Peter had been growling and snarling, a bad-tempered dog she had never encountered before, apparently ready to bite anything that moved. And that expression, that... But her mind snapped shut on that before it could go any further. She got the engine going again and then headed out of the parking lot. As she passed the side of the building, Augusta Veterinary Clinic, the neat sign read, she rolled her window down. A few barks and yaps, nothing out of the ordinary. It had stopped. And that wasn't all that had stopped, she thought. Although she couldn't be completely sure, she thought her period was over too. If so, good riddance to bad rubbish, to coin a phrase. 5. Bobby didn't want to wait, or couldn't, to get back before having the drinks she had promised herself. Just outside the Augusta city limits was a roadhouse that went by the charming name of the Big Lost Weekend Bar and Grill. Whopper's Spare Ribs, our specialty. The Nashville Kitty Cats, this fry and sad.
Anderson pulled in between an old station wagon and a John Deere tractor with a dirty harrow on the back with its blades kicked up. Further down was a big old Buick with a horse trailer behind. Anderson had kept away from that on purpose. "Stay," Anderson said, and Peter, now curled up on the seat, gave her a look as if to say, "Why would I want to go anywhere with you, so you can choke me some more with that stupid leash?" The big lost weekend was dark and nearly deserted on a Wednesday afternoon, its dance floor a cavern which glimmered faintly. The place reeked of sour beer. The bartender, cum counterman, strolled down and said, "Howdy, pretty lady. The chili's on special. Also, I'd like a cutty, Sark," Anderson said. "Double. Water back." "You always drink like a man?" "Usually from a glass," Anderson said. A quip which made no sense at all, but she felt very tired and harrowed to the bone. She went into the ladies to change her pad and did slip one of the minis from her purse into the crotch of her panties as a precaution. But precaution was all it was, and that was a relief. It seemed that the Cardinal had flown off for another month. She returned to her stool in a better humor than she had left it, and felt better still when she had gotten half the drink inside her. "Say, I sure didn't mean to offend you," the bartender said. "Gets lonely in here afternoons. When a stranger comes in, my lip gets runny."
"My fault," Anderson said. "I haven't been having the best day of my life."
She finished the drink and sighed.
"You want another one, miss?"
"I think I like Purdy Lady better," Anderson thought, and shook her head. "I'll take a glass of milk, though. Otherwise I'll have acid indigestion all afternoon."
The bartender brought her the milk. Anderson sipped it and thought about what had happened at the vet's. The answer was quick and simple. She didn't know.
"But I'll tell you what happened when you brought him in," she thought. "Not a thing."
Her mind seized on this. The waiting room had been almost as crowded when she brought Peter in as it had been when she dragged him back out, only there had been no bedlam seen the first time. The place had not been quiet. Animals of different types and species, many of them ancient and instinctive antagonists, do not make for a library atmosphere when brought together. But it had been normal. Now, with the booze working in her, she recalled the man in the mechanic's coverall leading the boxer in. The boxer had looked at Peter. Peter had looked mildly back. No big deal. "So?"
"So drink your milk and get on home and forget it."
"Okay. And what about that thing in the woods? Do I forget that too?" Instead of an answer, her grandfather's voice came. "By the way, Bobby, what's that thing doing to you? Have you thought about that?"
She hadn't.
Now that she had, she was tempted to order another drink. Except another, even a single, would make her drunk. And did she really want to be sitting in this huge barn in the early afternoon getting drunk alone, waiting for the inevitable someone, maybe the bartender himself, to cruise up and ask what a pretty place like this was doing around a girl like her? She left a five on the counter and the bartender saluted her. On her way out, she saw a payphone. The phone book was dirty and dog-eared and smelled of used bourbon, but at least it was still there. Anderson deposited 20 cents, crooked the handset between shoulder and ear while she hunted through the V's and the yellow pages, then called Etheridge's clinic. Mrs. Alden sounded quite composed. In the background, she could hear one dog barking. One. "I didn't want you to think I stiffed you," she said, "and I'll mail your leash back tomorrow."
"Not at all, Ms. Anderson," she said.
"After all the years you've done business with us, you're the last person we'd worry about when it comes to deadbeats. As for leashes, we've got a closet full." Things seemed a little crazy there for a while.
Boy, were they ever! We had to call medics for Mrs. Perkins. I didn't think it was bad. She'll have needed stitches, of course, but lots of people who need stitches get to the doctor under their own power.
She lowered her voice a little, offering Anderson a confidence that she probably wouldn't have offered a man.
Thank God it was her own dog that bit her. She's the sort of woman who starts shouting lawsuit at the drop of a hat.
Any idea what might have caused it?
No. Neither does Dr. Etheridge. The heat after the rain, maybe? Dr. Etheridge said he heard of something like it once at a convention. A vet from California said all the animals in her clinic
had what she called a savage spell just before the last big quake out there.
Is that so?
There was an earthquake in Maine last year, Mrs. Alden said.
Hope there won't be another one. That nuclear plant at Wiscasset is too close for comfort.
Just ask Guard, Bobby thought.
She said thanks again and hung up.
Anderson went back to the truck. Peter was sleeping. He opened his eyes when Anderson got in, then closed them again. His muzzle lay on his paws. The gray on that muzzle was fading away. No question about it. No question at all.
And by the way, Bobby, what's that thing doing to you?
Shut up, Granddad.
She drove home, and after fortifying herself with a second scotch, a weak one, she went into the bathroom and stood close to the mirror, first examining her face and then running her fingers through her hair, lifting it and then letting it drop. The gray was still there, all of it that had so far come in, as far as she could tell. She never would have thought she would be glad to see gray hair, but she was, sort of.
6. By early evening, dark clouds had begun to build up in the west, and by dark it had commenced thundering. The rains were going to return, it seemed, at least for a one-night stand. Anderson knew she wouldn't get Peter outside that night to do more than the most pressing doggy business. Since his puppyhood, the beagle had been utterly terrified of thunderstorms. Anderson sat in her rocker by the window, and if someone had been there, she supposed it would have looked like she was reading. But what she was really doing was grinding. Grinding grimly away at the thesis, Range War and Civil War. It was as dry as dust, but she thought it was going to be extremely useful when she finally got around to the new one, which should be fairly soon now. Each time the thunder rolled, Peter edged a little closer to the rocker and Anderson, seeming almost to grin shamefacedly.
Yeah, it's not going to hurt me, I know, but I'll just get a little closer to you, okay? And if there comes a real blast, I'll just about crowd you out of that fucking rocker. What do you say? You don't mind, do you, Bobby?
The storm held off until 9 o'clock, and by then Anderson was pretty sure they were going to have a good one, what the Havenites call a real geezer. She went into the kitchen, rummaged in the walk-in closet that served as her pantry, and found her Coleman gas lantern on a high shelf. Peter followed directly behind her, tail between his legs, shame-faced grin on his face. Anderson almost fell over him coming out of the closet with the lantern.
"Do you mind, Peter?"
Peter gave a little ground, and then crowded up to Anderson's ankles again when thunder cannonaded hard enough to rattle the windows. As Anderson got back to her chair, lightning sheeted blue-white, and the phone tinged. The wind began to rise, making the trees rustle and sigh. Peter sat hard by the rocker, looking up at Anderson, pleadingly.
"Okay," she said with a sigh. "Come on up, jerk."
Peter didn't have to be asked twice. He sprang onto Anderson's lap, getting her crotch a pretty good one with one forepaw. He always seemed to wang her there or on one boob. He didn't aim, it was just one of those mysterious things, like the way elevators invariably stopped at every floor when you were in a hurry. If there was a defense, Bobby Anderson had yet to find it. Thunder tore across the sky. Peter crowded against her. His smell, eau de beagle, filled Anderson's nose.
"Why don't you just jump down my throat and have done with it, Pete?"
Peter grinned his shamefaced grin as if to say,
I know it, don't rub it in."
The wind rose, the lights began to flicker, a sure sign that Roberta Anderson and Central Maine Power were about to bid each other a fond adieu, at least until 3 or 4 in the morning. Anderson laid the thesis aside and put her arm around her dog. She didn't really mind the occasional summer storm, or the winter blizzards for that matter. She liked their big power. She liked the sight and sound of that power working on the land in its crude and blindly positive way. She sensed insensate compassion in the workings of such storms. She could feel this when working inside her. The hair on her arms and the nape of her neck stirred, and a particularly close shot of lightning left her feeling almost galvanized with energy.
She remembered an odd conversation she'd once had with Jim Gardner. Gard had a steel plate in his skull, a souvenir of a skiing accident that had almost killed him at the age of 17. Gardner had told her that once, while changing a light bulb, he had gotten a hell of a shock by inadvertently sticking his forefinger into the socket. This was hardly uncommon. The peculiar part was that for the next week he had heard music and announcers and newscasts in his head. He told Anderson he had really believed for a while he was going crazy. On the fourth day of this, Gard had even identified the call letters of the station he was receiving, WZON, one of Bangor's three AM radio stations. He had written down the names of three songs in a row, and then called the station to see if they had indeed played those songs, plus ads for Singh's Polynesian Restaurant, Village Subaru, and the Bird Museum in Bar Harbor. They had. On the fifth day, he said, the signal started to fade, and 2 days later it was gone entirely. "It was that damn skull plate," he had told her, rapping his fist gently on the scar by his left temple. "No doubt about it. I'm sure thousands would laugh, but in my own mind, I'm completely sure." If someone else had told her the story, Anderson would have believed she was having her leg pulled. But Jim hadn't been kidding. You looked in his eyes and you knew he wasn't. Big storms had big power. Lightning flared in a blue sheet, giving Anderson a shuddered click of what she had come to think of, as her neighbors did, as her dooryard. She saw the truck with the first drops of rain on its windshield, the short dirt driveway, the mailbox with its flag down and tucked securely against its aluminum side, the writhing trees. Thunder exploded a bare moment later, and Peter jumped against her, whining. The lights went out. They didn't bother dimming or flickering or messing around. They went out all at once, completely. They went out with authority. Anderson reached for the lantern, and then her hand stopped. There was a green spot on the far wall, just to the right of Uncle Frank's Welsh dresser. It bobbed up 2 inches, moved left, then right. It disappeared for a moment, then came back. Anderson's dream recurred with all the eerie power of déjà vu. She thought again of the lantern in Poe's story, but mixed in this time was another memory. The War of the Worlds, the Martian heat ray raining green death on Hammersmith. She turned toward Peter, hearing the tendons in her neck creak like dirty door hinges, knowing what she was going to see. The light was coming from Peter's eye, his left eye. It glared with the witchy green light of St. Elmo's fire drifting over a swamp after a still, muggy day. No, not the eye. It was the cataract that was glowing, at least what remained of the cataract. It had gone back noticeably even from that morning at the vet's office. That side of Peter's face was lit with a lurid green light, making him look like a comic book monstrosity. Her first impulse was to get away from Peter, dive out of the chair and simply run. But this was Peter, after all, and Peter was scared to death already. If she deserted him, Peter would be terrified. Thunder cracked in the black. This time both of them jumped. Then the rain came in a great sighing, sheet-like rush. Anderson looked back at the wall across the room again, at the green splotch bobbing and weaving there. She was reminded of times she had lain in bed as a child, using the watch band of her Timex to play a similar spot off the wall by moving her wrist. And by the way, what's it doing to you, Bobby? Green sunken fire in Peter's eye, taking away the cataract, eating it. She looked again, and had to restrain herself from jerking back when Peter licked her hand. That night, Bobby Anderson slept hardly at all.